It's always a pleasure to talk to our next guest. He says to be a writer, you have to be an observer. The 26 essays in Lunch with a Bigot are Amitava Kumar's observations of the world put into words. It's a mix of memoir and reportage and criticism. The essays include encounters with writers Salman Rushdie and Arundhati Roy, discussions on the craft of writing, and a portrait of the struggles of a Bollywood actor. The title essay is Kumar's account of his visit to a member of an ultra-right Hindu organization who put him on a hit list. In these and other essays, he tells a broader story of immigration, change, and a shift to a more globalized existence, all the while demonstrating how he practices being a writer in this world of ours. Amitava Kumar is Helen D. Lockwood Professor of English at Vassar College. He is author of A Matter of Rats, which is just a great title. A foreigner carrying in the crook of his arm a tiny bomb, and Nobody Does the Right Thing. The new book, Lunch with a Bigot. Amitava Kumar, thank you very much for being with us.
Such a pleasure to be here, Joe. Thanks.
Always wonderful to have you. Man, you've got the thing down with titles for books.
You think so?
I like yes. him.
The next one is going to be called Migrant Montana.
This is great.
Right.
They're either like great book titles or band names. They're just very, very cool. So, Lunch with a Bigot, as I mentioned, is one of the essays in the collection. But let us talk about that idea of a collection as a whole. Of what is there a particular point you want to make in a collection other than here is a representation of my work? Or do you strive for some sort of theme or just a snapshot of what you're doing at a given time period?
Yes. You know, when I was starting out in college, I went for a poetry contest. And the judge said later on, in a remark that perhaps might have been addressed to me particularly, he said, if you don't have anything to write, don't write, please. And I hated him for saying that, but I knew he was right. So how does one search for material? And later on reflecting, I thought, what were the things that were happening at that time when I was, you know, in my late teens? Around me, there had been the worst industrial disaster in Bhopal. Indira Gandhi was shot. There had been riots. Why was I not writing about them? So it was later, with the discovery of writing as my real vocation, that I produced a body of work. And for me, the main task of this collection is to answer that question that judge had posed 30 years ago. What do you have to write? What can you write about? And a collection, for me, represents an attempt to gather together and show what is it that is your obsession.
That is a different ideology than what is so often taught in writing, which is just journal, write what you know, write everything. When you have a thought about a toaster oven, write it down.
Yes. No. Instead of that solipsism, what one must do as a writer is turn towards the world. Of course, there has to be a practice of inwardness. There has to be introspection. But it's really about discovering what you don't know. It's about discovering things about yourself and about the world that offers you interesting outlooks on life. And hence my encounter, for example, with a man who put me on the hit list.
Right. So, and I want to talk about that. But
sure.
But there's that idea of writing of what we don't know. To me, there's a type of person who feels that there's a lot that they do know.
Yes.
And then there are people, and I would certainly put myself in this category,
yes,
who feels when asked that, yeah, I really don't know a whole lot about it. That's why I'm in the business I'm in, of asking questions of finding out why people do what they do.
That's right.
So there, it seems to me, using your definition,
yes,
that there are people who are sort of genetically conditioned to be able to write in a way of wanting to know and caring and being interested and ultimately having that curiosity.
Yeah, except I would say that you modulate your genes by reading, which I mean to suggest that if you're reading, your curiosity gets sparked, and
sure,
therefore you develop an interest in the world that was not there before.
Right.
Earlier you might have thought that you'll just sit down at a table and inspiration will gently fall like snow in early winter. you know,
mm-hmm.
and collect around you. It doesn't happen. Instead, if you wander out into the world, and wander out into the world in places where you have not been before, then you are likely to actually acquire an interest that you had been lacking earlier.
So you become, you have this encounter, and you ultimately end up on a hit list by this ultra-right Hindu organization. So this happens in life, and at what point do you start writing about it and understanding it?
Yes.
I guess what I'm ultimately asking you is does there have to be time? Does thinking and meditating on it have to happen before you can, at least in a commercial sense, of put it out there, of say, okay, this is what I need to do to
yes
figure this all out?
Yeah. I think sometimes that distance helps. Not everything needs to be done that way.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'd like to write, you know, in ways, and I'd like to encourage my students to write, in ways where what they're writing is like blood on the bandage, you know?
Something is happening. What happening at that time.
Exactly. That's a great challenge too.
Mm-hmm.
To have your own self respond to what is happening in ways that are vivid and fresh.
Sure.
It's a challenge as a writer. Some things I think are best written later. The last piece in this collection, for example, is about the death of my mother.
Yes.
But I began writing something when I heard the news and I was on the plane going to India for the funeral. I wrote a little obituary. But as the days passed, there were other ways in which I thought I could add to what I was feeling. And I imagine other people would do the same. You know, everyone who experienced 9/11, wouldn't their experiences be different if they were waiting to write and wrote after making other discoveries, just to understand how grief had transformed them over the years, or how certain memories kept coming back to them, or what had faded? What was the strong impression of another presence in their life that had faded? So in other words, what I'm saying is there can be writing that is immediate, urgent, and then there can be writing that comes to you after many years, in the way there can be an earthquake, like an aftershock.
Mm.
And that's what the writing then becomes, the recording of that movement.
The essay in which you write about your mother is entitled Missing Person.
Yes.
Who do you feel the missing person is?
That's a good question. That's a very good question, because obviously I had first thought, after seeing these signs in the place where I went to put her ashes in the Ganges, there were these signs for missing persons. And people imagined, I think, that if your relative had gone missing, maybe they had gone to a place where they wanted to retreat from life.
Mm.
This was a holy place. But I was thinking of my mother. But now that you've asked the question, actually, I'm thinking of also about myself, though I had not realized it at that time, because when you are so grief-stricken, what you are struck by is not only the person who has died, about, you know, the absence of the person who has died, but in some ways you're not present to yourself. I certainly felt a hollowness about me. And the only reason I was taking down notes at that time was because I wanted to know who this person was who was feeling these things, or not feeling some things. So I, too, was the missing person, I guess.
And that is so scary, isn't it, and I've had that experience having lost my parents and my father's birthday today, oddly, so I've been thinking about this.
Sure.
But what you just said really struck me, because it's not so much always what you're feeling, but sometimes what you're not feeling.
Yes.
And that can scare the hell out of you.
Yeah, because everything that you had expected to feel, everything that movies had taught you or maybe a novel had taught you that you will feel, need not happen.
Mm.
It might. You might find that you are responding in precisely in ways you had seen an actor respond on stage, for example. But then you also begin to discover your differences. And what is scary then is that this seems to be like a new person that you're faced with. And right. this grieving self is someone that you did not know was there. I had not thought that I would be such a mess after my mother passed away. And that was a discovery for me. And it was in some ways scary, alienating. Mm-hmm. But also, as I found, taking down my notes, assuring, because I then began to understand a little bit more about myself.
So tell me a little bit about the note-taking
yes.
process.
Yes.
And that is you, what do you want to capture in that moment when you're taking down a note? What is it that you want to, and you're now taking out a notebook, which
yes.
is very, very cool.
Your readers can't see this, but it's a thin notebook that looks like a passport almost.
It
wouldn't
does.
You say, Joe?
Yeah? Very much so.
And especially when I'm, as I say to my students, you have to write every day and walk every day. Especially when I'm out for a walk, something will come to me, an idea about something I'm writing on, and I take down a phrase. At other times, this note-taking is that immediate impression of the world, you know, that I don't want to. I think the fact that there is a notebook close to my heart here makes me alert to the world. In the same way as a photographer carrying a camera must be a bit more alert at that time than when she or he is without a camera.
Sure.
They're framing pictures. So this notebook assures me that, yes, I'm a writer, attentive to the world.
It gives you an assurance. Does it also give you a responsibility that when you see something that you feel you must capture it then in writing? And
yes.
and that it's almost a triage, if you will, that if it rises to that occasion, that okay, this event does rise to this occasion, this event does not rise to that occasion.
Yes. Regarding the latter part, I think like the eye, you know, you said in your introductory remark that to be a writer is to be an observer.
Right.
And the eye does not judge. Your eye does not judge what you're looking at or you're not looking at. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, you might sometimes shut your eyes, but when you're looking, you're not judging. So you're not judging whether this is important or not important. And so in my notebook, I'm not immediately faced with the question, should I note this down or not? If the impulse comes, I'm there to greet it.
Right.
Cool. Now, does it give me a responsibility? Well, there is that when I meet the bigot, for example, and he says extremely vile things about my wife, I report that, you know, this was in an era before cell phones. I called my wife from a payphone, and she said, and I, you know, I blurted out what he had said, and she said, what did you say? And I said nothing. Why? Well, because I felt my responsibility as a writer was to keep telling myself, I need to remember everything that he is saying. And therefore, the moment I got back in the subway, I began to write down everything he had said. So the responsibility is that of reporting or taking down without judgment, like the eye open to the world.
Mm. And through that, what we get as readers is a feeling of, because you do get a feeling of intimacy.
Yes.
And knowing you and knowing your thoughts.
Yes.
And that is, and I assume the hope is that rings true with someone in the writing and that they can understand it and be able to extrapolate and further the conversation in their own mind.
Exactly. Because the person who is judging or is omniscient is removed from you on a human scale. Instead, the person who shares, who's confused, for example, or shares contradictions with you, or is aware of his or her complicities, seems more real to you. And that certainly, I think, is the role of the writer, to be exposing the ways in which you are indeed human.
That idea of making connections to things that you would have been unaware of or would not have thought you would make connections to is interesting to me.
Yes. I think, you know, as Ian Foster said, only connect. And aware of the challenges to such connection, too. What is it that divides me from you at any particular moment? To be attentive to that fact.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back and continue our conversation. Amitava Kumar has a beautiful new collection out called Lunch with a Bigot, The Writer in the World, and he is going to be at Inquiring Minds Bookstore in New Paltz tonight at 7 p.m. We'll talk more about that and about his work a little bit more and some of the other essays in the book right after this short break. Amitava Kumar is the Helen D. Lockwood Professor of English at Vassar College. His new collection of essays and creative nonfiction is Lunch with a Bigot. It is published, as all of his work is, by Duke University Press. He will be at Inquiring Minds Bookstore in New Paltz tonight at 7 o'clock, talking about reading and signing the book. And he is with us this morning, and we're quite thrilled about that. I'm hoping you can honor us by reading a little bit from the book.
Sir, it will be a pleasure. When I was promoted to the rank of professor, the library at the university where I was then employed asked me to send them the name of a book that had been useful to me in my career. I chose V.S. Naipaul's Finding the Center. The library then purchased a copy, which was duly displayed in one of its rooms with a statement I had written about the book. And this was the statement. This was one of the first literary autobiographies that I read. Its very first sentence established in my mind the idea of writing as an opening in time or a beginning. That sentence conveyed to me, with its movement and rhythm, a history of repeated striving and of things coming together at last in the achievement of the printed word. And I'm now going to read the sentence of Naipaul's. It is now nearly 30 years since, in a BBC room in London, on an old BBC typewriter and on smooth, non-rustle BBC paper, I wrote the first sentence of my first publishable book, unquote. This first sentence, about a first sentence, created an echo in my head. It has lasted through the 20 years of my writing life. The ambition and the anxiety of the beginner is there at the beginning of each book. Every time I start to write, I'm reminded of Naipaul's book.
That is Amitava Kumar reading from a chapter in Lunch with a Bigot, one of the essays entitled The Rules, 10 Rules of Writing, 10 Rules of Writing. Do you believe, and I'm asking this of a professor, so do you believe that does there always have to be rules, and are rules strict, or are rules meant, you know, made to be broken when it comes
yes.
to
creativity?
Because you're talking about creativity. You're talking about
I know.
My life versus your life versus his experience versus her experience, and how does that all work?
Yeah. I'm sure when I lay down rules, some of my students must, in their own minds at least, rebel against it. They want to throw them out of the window. But in my mind, these rules are there to help you start, to help you get started. So for example, at the start of each year, I give out this rule by Ray Bradbury that says they should try to write a short story each week.
Mm.
And why? Well, he explains, it's not possible to write 52 bad short stories in a row, meaning in a year, you know? You have to do this for a year. And I think, okay, that'd be useful. In the same way as I read in another book that Jennifer Egan told herself while she was writing her last book, which won the Pulitzer Prize,
mm-hmm.
that she was only going to write a short, bad book. I'm going to have that next to my writing desk soon because that's enormously liberating. It's a rule. I'm going to write a short, bad book, but it should liberate you, free you from the anxiety, because writing is difficult,
mm-hmm.
you know? So my rules, yes, they are supposed to be broken, but if you need help, they are there for you to give your days a certain structure and your, you know, your strivings a certain goal.
And then just that idea of what's good and bad, right?
Sure.
Writing a bad book.
Yeah.
And that may, what would you think? Although this was told to me long ago,
yes,
and I
yes.
assume this is true, that
yes.
that if you as the writer, you as the creator, you
yeah.
as the whatever, the filmmaker, the producer, whatever, if you feel that it's crummy, then probably the audience is going to feel that it's crummy.
Yeah, yeah. No, this isn't an injunction that you write a bad book.
Right.
It is simply the idea that, okay, I'll just write a bad book. It's to free you from the anxiety that,
sure.
oh, I'm not writing great book.
Right.
But in the end, No, you have to believe that it is good, and only then should you be responsible for bringing it out into the world.
And I guess it's what I'm getting to is that idea of what is good and bad, of who makes that judgment. If you feel that it's good,
yes,
and you send it out into the world, and then it gets shot to hell, well, is it is it still good? Sure, right? It's still,
yes,
because it's good to you.
Yes, I think there has to be some self-belief. One year should be open to the world, but the other year should be listening to your inside voice. I think so.
Hmm.
Because, you know, how can you listen to the others if you're an artist? But how can you close yourself from the world if you're living in the world? Both.
Do you know why so many of us want to be writers?
Because we have things to say. Because we want to work out what has happened to us. Because we want to sort out, through the act of writing, what is not necessarily clear. I think that should be the purpose of writing.
So it doesn't have the stigma of going to see a therapist.
I have to say, I've never been to a therapist, but one of my students has been writing essays. And I think she has a book there because her conversations are so interesting.
Mm.
The therapist is functioning as a page that answers back. So it becomes a conversation. You know, she's writing down her thoughts about herself, about her sexuality, but the therapist is just providing enough resistance for her to go on. And I guess all of us are, in some ways, sorting those questions out when we write essays in particular, mm. You know?
And because you're always in this collection, which is a beautiful collection, it seems that you're trying to figure things out. You're working them out, and you're working them out on paper. And I've asked many writers this, and I've gotten many different replies, which, yeah, I find fascinating.
Yes.
Which is, when you're writing, when you start the process, have you already come to your conclusion, or is it through the writing process that you reach that,
yeah,
destination?
Joe, if you have guests here who say that they already know what they are going to write when they write, you should stop reading them, because their writing will be dead, is dead.
Yes.
It is precisely when the writing conveys the writer's attempt to find the truth at the tip of the pen that they arrive at some discovery. And you are therefore, and you as a writer then are a part of that journey.
Can I write that down and add that to my rejection letter when I send people a no? I'm not going to feature their book in the show?
Yeah.
Like that?
Yes.
I'm sorry, your writing is dead to me.
It's harsh.
Well, it is, it is and it isn't, right?
Yeah, you have the responsibility of telling the truth.
Right, of course. Is it, when you put out a collection like this, and you'll be at Inquiring Minds, as I mentioned tonight, yeah, and you talk to people and you read, what do you hope ultimately people get out of the experience? What do you want them to get out of that experience?
I think from listening to me, as I hope your readers are, it is about a mind at work, which is what an essay should also do. An essay is literally an attempt at doing something.
Mm.
So from listening or being at a reading, people should discover the process. And that's what we are doing, you and I, right now. The discovery of the process of finding words that have ended in this printed book. But as to collection itself, I hope from the range of things, because these are here divided between writing, reading, places, people, I hope actually to convey how is a body of work over many years created?
Mm.
How do you move from having written a poem or an op-ed or an essay to collecting something, to producing something that in some ways represents your outlook and your search for material as a writer, represents a writer's credo? And for me, that credo has been that of observation.
I love discovering and discussing a process of creativity, and that process is endlessly fascinating to me. And I have found over the years that there are many people who have struggled in detailing how they do it. And I always enjoy speaking to you because you have such a beautiful eloquence of being able to discuss how you do it and bring
you're
it together.
You're very kind. You're very kind. I think teaching has helped in that way, because you're always making something transparent, you know,
sure,
to the kids. Yeah,
that makes sense. Well, the name of the new collection is Lunch with a Bigot. It is published by Duke University Press. Again, Amitava Kumar will be at Inquiring Minds Bookstore in New Paltz tonight at 7 o'clock. And I can't thank you enough for coming in this morning.
Sir, it's an honor.
Great delight to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Amitava Kumar will be at Inquiring Minds Bookstore in New Paltz tonight at 7 o'clock. The name of the new collection, it's in paperback, Lunch with a Bigot by Amitava Kumar, published by Duke University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.